That was a section of Jamil Jamal by trumpeter Yaz Ahmed from her album Les Saboteurs. I'm Phil Freeman, and this is episode 8 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. If you're listening to us for the first time, welcome. And if you've been with us since the beginning, welcome back. We're on iTunes and Stitcher and other podcast aggregator sites, and if you'd like, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. So Yaz Ahmed put that record out last year on her own label, and it was really, really well received by critics. She wound up on a lot of year-end lists, including my own, not only on Burning Ambulance, but also on lists I put together for Stereo Gum and The Wire. And she was just one of a number of young, I mean, young by jazz standards, so under 50, young musicians coming out of England and getting a lot of critical respect. Some others include saxophonist Camilla George, singer Zara McFarlane, the saxophone drums team Binker and Moses, the piano trio Go-Go Penguin, and saxophonist Nubia Garcia. So here's another piece of music. This is Hold, and it's from Nubia Garcia's debut EP, Nubia's 5. So yeah, Nubia Garcia. She is one of a number of these up-and-coming British jazz musicians who are all featured on a compilation called We Out Here, coming out in February. In fact, she's a major participant on that record. She's featured with her own quartet as part of the all-female ensemble Nerea, and she plays on 3 other tracks. She's on a total of 5 pieces out of 9 on the album. And the whole thing was assembled and produced by another really important British artist at the moment, Shabaka Hutchings. Like Garcia, he's got 3 different groups going. He's in Sons of Kemet, who have a new album coming out on Impulse in March. He's in The Comet Is Coming. And he's got Shabaka and the Ancestors, which is him working with a bunch of South African jazz musicians. They did one album in 2016, and they'll be recording another one later this year. Yaz, Nubia, and Shabaka were all in New York recently to perform at Winter Jazz Fest, and I managed to get them all together in a single room for a roundtable interview, which is what you're going to hear on this episode of the podcast. It was a lot of work to coordinate their schedules, apparently, so I have to go out of my way to thank Matt Merowitz, who did publicity for Winter Jazz Fest, for setting all this up. I had a great time talking to the 3 of them. We covered a whole bunch of topics, including their individual albums, their collaborations, their educational backgrounds. We talked about the cultural impact of Brexit. So I'm going to play one more piece of music, This is Black Faces, Black Masks, Shabaka's track from We Out Here, on which he plays bass clarinet. So listen to that, and then you'll hear my interview with Yaz Ahmed, Nubaya Garcia, and Shabaka Hutchings. So yeah, I'll start with you. Shabaka, you've just signed with Impulse and will be releasing the third Sons of Kemet album in March. So I haven't heard it yet. So can you talk a little bit about it and how the group's music has evolved from the last album to this one?
So one of the aspects of the new Sons of Kemet album that we've been trying to incorporate is just the atmosphere that we get live. We've always treated the last two studio albums as albums. So we craft a piece through the studio, and then we go on the road and we play to all these audiences in London and England and Europe who want a party, but they want a party but the partying is functional in having them like become receptive to, you know, the tradition of jazz and the tradition of Caribbean music and the tradition of Afrobeat and all these different areas. So it feels like that immersive experience of having various forms of music take prominence within a particular musical sphere. That's what we've been trying to create on the album, you know. So it's got the hype of when you come to a gig and you get immersed in, you know, artists just playing with everything that they've got, but it's also got some musical elements, I guess, because it's supposed to be, you know, jazz music, mm-hmm. and jazz is supposed to have some elements of consideration, I guess.
Yeah. So was it recorded faster than the others, since you're not playing around with this stuff as much, or...?
No, we recorded it in two sessions. I'm a fan of, like, short recording processes, so both of the other two Sons of Kemet albums, we spent 2 days in the studio recording mm-hmm. them. This we spent 2 days, and then we took a break, I wrote some new tunes, and then we had one more day. And then it took a long time to, like, mix it and get everything ready with the recordings. Mm-hmm. It's called Your Queen is a Reptile, and the whole kind of concept of that was thinking about the concept about what it means to have people who you revere, have women who you revere. What are the qualities of our leaders that we want to actually acknowledge and further? So it didn't start with Your Queen is a Reptile. It started with thinking, who are the people, the women that I think could be worthy of this status in my life? So lots of research, people like Angela Davis, Harriet Tubman, Berta Carceres, and loads of different women came up, and it's like looking at the mythology of the aspects of the monarchy. So the idea that someone hereditarily has more prominence or more entitlement than someone else just because of their bloodline is a myth that as a society we decide or don't decide to take on and acknowledge. So I'm saying, if I don't agree with that myth and I see that myth as, you know, just something that we've decided on, what if I have the agency to bring my own myths into the societal sphere? And my myth is that the queen is a reptile. You know, and that should hold as much prominence as the myth of her being more than entitled than me just because she's of a particular bloodline.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Yes, your album did really, really well on a lot of critics' polls in 2017, which probably opens you up to a lot of touring opportunities and things like that. But at the same time, there's the pressure to follow something like that up. So given that your album's title refers to a kind of self-sabotaging inner voice, what are you going to do next? Tell us now.
Okay, so I'm really excited about the next album. It actually features a bit of Nabaya on it. It's a recording of my Women of the World suite, which was premiered on International Women's Day in 2015 at the Women of the World Festival. And it's a piece that's inspired by positive female role models, sort of women who have contributed to history, who've made a big difference, you know, in our everyday lives. So there are people like Rosa Parks, Malala Yousafzai, suffragettes. Yeah, so they all play a part in this piece of music.
I'm kind of seeing a co-headlining tour coming together here.
Yeah, so it's a completely different project, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's with an all-female band. So it features some of the musicians from the Tomorrow's Warriors and some other musicians I've invited that I love working with as well. So it's a celebration of, I suppose, female power. And I think it's going to be special.
And do you have any idea when that's coming?
I'm hoping autumn this year, but I kind of take my time with albums, not Deutsche Bank, but I take quite a few years. So hopefully it'll be ready this year.
Yeah. Now, Nabaya, in addition to your own record, you're a member of Maisha and Nereja, both of which both of which also have EPs out. So. Is any one of those ensembles more important for you than the others, and what do you have planned for 2018?
No, basically. There's no hierarchy, basically, in the bands that I'm a part of, other than my own, basically. They've kind of been building for a few years now, so the way that I like to do things is just... treat them with the same importance, because that's what they are to me, and I value everyone I play with, and it's not like I've chosen one higher than the other. Hasn't really worked that way for me, which I think is really good. I've got a release coming up in March, 8th of March. I'm releasing an EP. And then we're doing a lot of gigs abroad this year, and then start work on the album.
Now, you all have worked together a lot, obviously. Is the London scene just really close-knit in general, or did I just coincidentally request interviews with a bunch of people who all know each other?
I think the scene is pretty close-knit, just because, like, for one, geographically, London isn't... In some ways, it is big in that there are lots of musicians, but it isn't big in that, you know, the places that we all frequent are pretty kind of small. There are different scenes, but there are a lot of people that circumvent those scenes that are able to cross over. Like me and Yaz went to study together in Guildhall, School of Music, so that's where we started our musical relationship. Nubaya went to Trinity School of Music, and I didn't know her in that time, but it's within the same scene, and we both did the Tomorrow's Warriors group, so it's within similar scenes of like a kind of musical influence, and there's people who always like kind of take prominent roles in terms of different directions at certain periods of time. And yeah, in some ways, actually, yeah, it is a small scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could you explain, all three of you, I guess, what Tomorrow's Warriors is and how it works for a U.S. audience? Because I don't think there's anything comparable here.
So Tomorrow's Warriors is an, I guess, an institution that stemmed from a group called the Jazz Warriors that was functioning in the 80s that had people like Courtney Pine, it had people like Alfie Robinson, Cleveland Watkiss, Steve Williamson, a lot. And I think the basis of it, it wasn't exclusively black, but the basis of it was to redress the balance of black musicians where you had a almost like a big band formation that featured heavily people of Afro-Caribbean diasporic roots playing music that reflected that part of their musical heritage going forward into the tradition of jazz that they were all a part of. When that kind of progressed, everyone had, you know, their own solo adventures through the 90s. Gary Crosby decided to have an extension of that group called Tomorrow's Warriors, which was in essence a way of young musicians similar to the Jazz Warriors, predominantly but not exclusively black, have a way of giving them a gig. So you'd have a band and for a year they'd have a gig maybe at the Spice of Life or originally it was at the Jazz Cafe where they could work on new material, work on skills for a band. Sometimes you get a mentor. So when I did it for a year, we had Abram Wilson, who's a trumpeter from New Orleans. He lived in England. He was mentoring us and we got to learn lots of jazz repertoire, work on our own tunes. And yeah, it's just a way that a lot of us learned how to begin the journey into jazz.
Are all of you the children of immigrants to the UK? You know, like, were your parents born there? Or the reason I ask is because it seems like you all came through, you know, schools and art institutions and stuff like that. So when you announced your decision to become professional musicians, it may not have been greeted with shock and horror the way it would have been in America if the child of immigrants would say, I want to be a professional jazz musician. It would be like, you know, the worst thing ever. So, I mean, was there that support, you know, when...
Yeah, I think my family supported me a lot. I mean, my mum got me involved in playing music from a really young age. My older brothers and sisters all played music. And then went on to do different things, but there was a lot of support, and my mum took me to gigs all the time. It was a really important thing that we did when I was younger, and still now. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's like over here, but there was definitely, it wasn't really much of a surprise for them, let's say.
Yeah, because like when I talked to Matthew Shipp, the piano player, you know, I asked him like, "What did your dad say when you know when you told him that you were going to be a jazz, you know, not only a professional musician but a professional jazz musician?" And he said, "You know, his dad was like, well, you know, Mozart starved to death, right?"
For me, it's just about the work ethic. So I think my mom wasn't necessarily concerned about what I did. It's more about the attitude that I did it with. So you could be studying engineering and go and do a university degree in that and still come out without a job or any money if you don't work hard at it and really commit yourself to actually what you want to get out of that, you know, area of life. So for me, I see music as the same thing. Like, being a musician is a job, and you can either conduct yourself with seriousness or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as with anything in life. So if you know what you're going to do, you know where you want to go, and you can think logically about the steps that you need to take to get there, it's the same for me as if you're working in as an investment banker, if you're working as a doctor. They're just like the necessary steps and the adult kind of things that you need to do, like to get your life in gear to be the best you can be at your chosen craft.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what music is. It is a craft.
Yeah, yeah. Yaz, you played on two tracks from The King of Limbs, the Radiohead record, and there's a version of Bloom on your album.
Mm-hmm.
How were you recruited for that project, and can you talk a little bit about Radiohead's process and whether you stole anything from that for your own sessions? Like, you know, whether you learned anything from how they worked in the studio?
Okay. Well, so first of all, Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead, he was looking for two flugelhorn players, and myself and my partner Noel were recommended, and so that's how we got the gig, basically. And so we visited the studio, and they played us some of the stuff that they've been inspired by. They played us some Alice Coltrane, and you know, it was quite surprising. I didn't realize they were into that kind of music. And so we did a bit of experimenting with some of the written parts that they had already prepared, and some improvising, and they just took it away and sort of, you know, made their own thing of what we did on the sessions. And I mean, I learned from that process that you can use the studio as a compositional tool. You know, there are so many possibilities, in, you know, that you don't have with live music. And so I really took that to heart, and I used a lot of those techniques in recording the Saboteurs. You know, and I love the way they work. They're incredibly serious. They're very, you know, very focused. When we did the live session, there were like three takes, and that's it. Move on to the next one. And yeah, they're brilliant to work with. And I love the use of electronics. And that's where I started using, I became curious about the Chaos Pad and stuff like that, sort of creating new sound worlds. And so, yeah, I find them very compelling, and yeah, sort of they've inspired me.
Your album was originally released as a series of EPs, sort of gradually rolled out. So what gave you that idea, and do you feel it works equally well as a full LP or as these four mini suites, or do you have a preference that you'd prefer people listen to it, or, you know?
I think the chapters work well on their own as individual pieces. But it is a different listening experience when you listen to the whole thing from start to end. You know, it's like a little journey. You know, I suppose it's a journey of my development as well, sort of embracing my mixed heritage as well as the sort of modern techniques I've been using with electronics and recordings.
Now, Nubia, when you started putting your five EP together, which I should point out has six tracks on it, what specifically did you want to do that you weren't doing in your other ensembles?
So it has six tracks because I couldn't decide between two versions of Hold. Hold is the one that has a version, a hip-hop version, and a kind of up-tempo, like, kind of soca version, basically. The label manager was like, you have to choose, and I was like, I want them both. So people are a bit confused. It's a bit confusing. So what was the second bit of your question?
Oh, what was it that you were looking to do differently from your other ensembles?
I think I just wanted to, the way that I put that EP together, it was, it's kind of like a very clear example of the different genres that influence me and have influenced me since, you know, I decided that I wanted to do this. I've been really into modal jazz for the last few years or more. There's a couple of modal jazz tunes-esque type things. And yeah, you've got the two versions of Hold, hip-hop, and the other one. And then Lost Kingdoms, again, is like a kind of just a really chilled groove. The EP is me like exploring. It's the first thing I've written, basically, and put a body of work together. It's just a way that I wanted to explore writing different styles of music, mm-hmm. and they fit together.
I think something that I've been noticing about a lot of the UK stuff that I've been hearing is then everybody here kind of incorporates African and Middle Eastern and other kind of non-Western instrumentation and rhythms and melodic structures and stuff like that. And I feel like there's a greater openness to that in British jazz right now than there is in New York. Like, there's a different palette of sounds that people pull from here. So, I mean, is that broadly true, or is it true of mostly what you guys and your peers are doing? Or,
you know, what is, I mean, like here, for example, from like in Brooklyn right now, there's a lot of people making this kind of super nerdy, modern classical chamber music influenced, everyone reading from sheet music kind of jazz.
Yes.
Is there that going on in London?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, like there is that going on in London, and there has been that. And for me, it's interesting, like if you look at, I can't remember the exact quote, but a quote by Karl Marx that goes something like, capitalism is normally seen as the relationship between people and commodities, rather than being seen as the relationship between people and people. And I think the same is true in music, in that it's actually, when you see a musician, depict himself in a certain way, like, you know, I have music and I want to depict myself in a way that pays homage to classical ideologies, classical aesthetics, you know, this is the kind of person who you're dealing with, not for better or worse, it's just, this is the personality. And maybe it seems that for various reasons or various traditions, we have a certain type of personality in London, and there's a certain kind of irreverence that maybe is more readily accepted than in the States. So, I mean, when we learn jazz, we're learning it from afar. So there's less reverence to exactly what is thought of as the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we see the tradition as a fluid thing because we don't have a direct line from the we don't have a perceived direct line from the beginning of it. You know, we see it as almost as an academic thing, like jazz is supposed to have been created in New Orleans, as opposed to having a direct image of where jazz is supposed to have started. So for me, jazz started in New Orleans, but New Orleans wasn't the beginning of creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New Orleans was one point in the trajectory of, you know, an African experience that has incorporated Western elements, has incorporated people of different races, different cultures, and we don't know where it's going to go. It's about an idea of making music that progresses from, for me, the beginning of creativity. At one point, it became jazz, and it kind of codified itself in terms that we can, you know, define by bebop or avant-garde jazz or whatever. And we don't know where it's going to go. This whole period could be a transition point towards a type of music or way of making music that's going to come in 50 years' time. You know, so for me, the exciting thing is seeing what like landmarks and what clues that we musicians are doing now that could be like could show us what the music of the future is going to be. And I think, yeah, like that's an interesting way of just viewing ourselves within the course of history, as opposed to saying, you know, we're all in fixed states in terms of where we are in the course of a tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, on the Sons of Kemet records, like I can hear, you know, obviously there's the tuba,
yeah.
You know, which draws back to New Orleans and is not really that common these days. Like I haven't thought of anybody seriously using a tuba in jazz since like Arthur Blythe in the early 80s.
Yeah.
You know, but then there's also on your records, there's like Afrobeat stuff going on, you know, and all sorts of things like that. So I'm very interested in that kind of sound that blends all these different things, because again, this is not something that is very commonly heard in New York. And I'm wondering why, you know, do you guys think why it's taken root in London in that way?
I think from the people that I have gone to see and the guys that I play with, for us, it seems to be you're always going to create music that has inspired you, basically. Other genres that have inspired you they're all going to come out in your music. So I think for me, definitely, all of the sounds that I'm trying to include in what I'm doing or what we're creating together, basically on stage and in the studio, there's such a range, and they all have equal weight. You know, we all met playing jazz, like traditional jazz, swing and bebop, but along that route, we started hanging out, we started going to other gigs. Many of us were at college together, we lived together, all of this stuff, blah, blah, blah. when you go to nights that aren't specifically like jazz nights, but you're taking so much from that and then bringing it back to, you know, the colleges and the Tomorrow's Warriors and the other jam sessions, there's so much that happened at jam sessions that weren't jazz jam sessions, strictly jazz, like, you know, the jazz club jam sessions, etc. Yeah, I think it's very true that you create what you've been listening to, an amalgamation of it, for me. So I think maybe that's why you're hearing such a range of influences in our music.
I think the audience has a lot to do with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
In that, you know, it's about, for me, like the challenge as an artist is to tread that line between what we want to express in terms of our own personal vision of what integrity is to us, considering all the music that we've learned, all the music that we like, and what we want to listen to when we go out, and what an audience wants when they come to hear us, because at the end of the day, we are entertainers. Whether we want to accept it or not, people want to be entertained, whether it's entertained in their heads or entertained in their bodies. They want to come to a show and see exactly that, a show. And it feels like in London there's been a progression of an audience that wants to be entertained in a way where their body can move to the music in a way that it would if they were going to any other night that they were going to. But they also want to be stimulated intellectually with the kind of functionality that jazz normally brings. So as an entertainer in that role, who could also consider himself to be a jazz musician or could also consider himself to just be a conductor of vibes in general. I kind of see the role of myself and the musicians of our generation in trying to find a way through that, you know, through all of these different courses, you know, how to make people dance, how to make people think, how to really just express all the kind of myriad types of music that we've all grown up loving and loving to hear, how to express that to an audience within the context of a space, you know, of the space that we're playing, because that's, you know, another thing, like we're playing in clubs, you know. We might be playing in a club one day and be playing in a traditional jazz venue the next, so how to arrange a set so it, you know, kind of fits all these different capacities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that I've been curious about was because I've been reading about the fact that, you know, there are a lot of sort of alternative venues, probably more than traditional sit down at a, you know, tiny tables, jazz clubs. And that's not really the case here. Again, you know, like in New York, it's all seated, you know, and stuff like that. And I've been agitating for a while now for like a campaign to just take all the seats out of jazz clubs. You know, I feel like it would increase appreciation for the music on, you know, and probably change the music in a big way if musicians knew that people were going to be standing up for an hour.
Yeah. When you're standing up, it is, you know, this sounds painfully obvious, but it is a different thing than when you're sitting down. You know, and it's as simple and as complex as you want to take it. If I'm, you know, sitting down listening to you talk to me or having a conversation with you, is going to be a different dynamic than if we're both standing up, you know, because generally when people stand, they don't stand still.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sway and they move slightly and they kind of move in accordance to the person that they're communicating with. When you sit, because most of our seating chairs aren't ergonomically designed, when you go into a venue, you're not getting a seat that actually is immersive. You're getting a contraption that you have to like stiffen yourself and actually tense yourself to sitting. You know, so automatically you're coming into a situation of tension and you think, okay, and mentally you're like, okay, I should be watching that person and being in reverence because I'm approaching this concert situation from a point of view of the classical aesthetic of the performer performs and I receive. You know, and sitting down just supplements that because you're sitting and you're tense and you've got a chair and someone's next to you and you can't move. Whereas when you're standing, all of a sudden, you're able to, in some ways, just do what you want to do. You can move to the back if you want. You can sway if you want. You know, the line between the performer on stage and you becomes a little bit closer.
So yeah.
Standing is good.
I want to go to each of you individually. And ask specifically about influence on your primary instrument. What influence took the longest to work out of your system or to like absorb it enough that you could honestly call it part of your own voice rather than something that you just got, you know, blasted with when you were starting?
Ah, okay. So I think it's quite complicated for me. Obviously, I mean, I grew up in Bahrain till I was 9, moved to the UK, and I kind of lost my identity, I think. And, you know, I felt sort of, I felt like there was something missing. And so when I came to my jazz studies, I was, you know, studying American jazz, British jazz. But, you know, it took a while to my sort of late 20s that I started to rediscover my roots. And I started listening to Rabbi Abu Khalil, oud player. And then I sort of, it struck a chord with me inside. And I felt that I became whole again, you know, sort of reconnecting with this kind of very spiritual, heartfelt music. And so, yeah, it's taken me a long time to sort of find my own identity, my personality.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, for me, it's been a very long journey, and I'm still discovering.
And so, but as far as, like, you, specifically on the trumpet or whatever, did you have, like, you know, a big Freddie Hubbard phase or, you know, something like that, you know, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to listen to Dizzy Gillespie a lot. I mean, he was the first trumpet player I was introduced to by my grandfather. He was a jazz trumpet player and record producer in the 50s. And yeah, so he would share with me all these old sort of bebop records. And that's kind of where my education started. I used to play along with these records and kind of not really understand what's going on, but sort of enjoyed the spirit of it. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't feel like I'm really influenced by anyone in particular. I'm not sure really. I just take bits, you know, from everyone and whoever I feel sort of close to emotionally.
Yeah, yeah. And Shabaka, what about you? I mean, I've heard you play sax, but I've heard you play clarinet, but I've never heard you play soprano, I don't think. So
I've got a soprano. I've actually got a really nice soprano.
Yeah.
I've got a 1920 Con. It's a beautiful instrument, and I don't like to play it that often. I like to keep that naivety so that whenever I pick it up, I just blow it and don't think too hard about whether it's any good. So I might play it for like one gig and then put it down for 4 months and then play it, you know. So.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just like, you know, it's a saxophone, you blow it and you wiggle your fingers.
Yeah.
And, you know, stuff comes out.
So, but were there any particular players when you were, you know, learning that, like, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I started on the clarinet, and that's my principal instrument.
Okay.
And I grew up in Barbados, so there were two Don Byron albums, really randomly, in the midst of a sea of smooth jazz. I don't know how it happened. There were two Don Byron albums in the music store in Barbados. A Romance with the Unseen, it's got Jack DeJohnette, Bill Frisell, and Drew Gress, and Bug Music, really,
okay,
which
sure.
is a tribute to John Kirby.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, just doing kind of very traditional early jazz, but in a really, really hip way, really well recorded. And that kind of blew my mind, how one person could be that eclectic. So, like, it felt like there was a mind unchained. Like, there was an artist, Don Byron, but before that, for me, an artist represented a specific type of music that they played. It wasn't that here is just a pure, like, vessel of creativity and whatever you can, you know, apply your creativity to, you just go down that path. And when I saw Don Byron, or like listened to Don Byron do these two radically different albums, I just thought, wow, this is another approach. It's not about learning how to be a particular type of musician or a particular type of genre-based musician. It's about how to be more musical in whatever you know, apply yourself to. Then obviously playing the saxophone, there've been periods of, you know, where I've liked people like Mark Turner, Seamus Blake, Joe Lafano, like the modern guys, periods of liking more the older guys, like you know, older people that you'd regularly like cite, Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Sam Rivers, Wayne Shorter. But my main influence as of late is trying to become what I've turned stupid sax. Now this is an interesting concept because, you know, we go through college and we have all these like things in the air, like in the zeitgeist that says you need to be better, And it comes from, like, we're in a capitalist system. We need to accumulate more jazz chops. We need more information. We need more facility. We need more everything. But what about if we don't need any more anything? What if we need to go back to a place where we just have our creativity and a piece of metal, you know? And I call that stupid sax. You take the saxophone and you just get ignorant. You know, it's like, and that's like, for me, it's like, I practice, I'll transcribe stuff and I'll practice out of etude books. But the real thing is when I'm on stage, trying to actually approach the instrument from a point of unknowing, from a point of trying to unknow and unlearn all that stuff. Like, I really don't want to sound like Mark Turner or Joe Lovano, because they just sound too good. They sound like they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I'd rather be that guy in the corner where people go, can he, I guess he can play, but can he really? I like that. Like, I like guys that can do that, you know?
Yeah.
And actually John Sermon, a British saxophone player, was the first person that talked to me about that, about learning about jazz and then trying to purposefully disregard its influence on your particular style of music.
I remember reading famously that Miles Davis told John McLaughlin at the Bitches Brew recording sessions, he told him to play like he didn't know how to play the guitar.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's just the best. Dump all that, you know.
Yeah. Guitarists are the worst for that, because they can practice without having anything plugged in, so they can sit down all day and just move the fingers until the fingers are so fast, and I'm just like, look man, just like cut one of them off or something. But we need to just stop playing all that.
Honestly, that was the best thing that ever happened to Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath, was, you know, because he used to work in a factory and he lost the ends of three of his fingers, and that's why he sounds like that. Because he literally wears little leather things on the ends of his fingers to play.
Yeah.
And so you get that caveman sound.
Exactly. Everyone's trying to be too good. People need to start to be bad.
Yeah.
But consistently bad. And like bad with strength and conviction.
Yeah. And Nubaya, what about you? Are you, how many instruments do you play? What saxophones do you play?
I play tenor saxophone, mainly a bit of Barry. I do not play alto saxophone or soprano really anymore.
Okay. Yeah,
low end basically. I started on alto for like, I don't know, years and years. And I switched to tenor 6 years ago and never touched the alto again. I think, oh, and I also play flute and a like very small a bit, very small amount of clarinet and bass clarinet as well. Influence wise, I think when I was starting out, I actually listened to a lot of piano players and trumpet players. And then later on, I kind of got into Bird pretty heavily. I was still playing alto at that time. Coltrane and Sonny and Dexter were like a huge influence on my younger self, I think. Kind of like a digestible introduction rather than trying to digest Giant Steps at the age of 13. I was like, I don't know what's going on. I'm going to put this down for a second. And, you know, I came back to it and it was a completely different experience, like however many years later. I think I do believe in listening to and absorbing things at the right time. I think it made a difference, you know, listening to it again at the age of whatever, 16 or 17 or 20 and 21 or something like that. I think I wasn't ready to digest late Coltrane the first time I heard it. On other records and etc. And I think it's been a really interesting process, the way that my opinions and thoughts about certain records have changed over the years. I really enjoy that. Yeah, those are kind of my main influences. McCoy, I think the sound world that he has kind of championed and created and become known for is forever going to be in my mind and heart of hearts.
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful.
The in the US, you know, the tradition was always for decades that like an older generation of musicians would hire young players for their bands and kind of train them on the bandstand. So Are there players in the UK that did that for any of you, or is that not the way things work there, or, you know?
Mixture. I think at the moment, we're kind of like, we've all come up together, the bands that I've been playing in regularly. I think, yeah, we, you know, we used to go to jam sessions together, then we started playing in quartets and quintets together and doing standards gigs and, you know, in small venues and pubs and stuff, and kind of getting a repertoire together, I guess. And then that moved on to us writing our own music and writing together as well as by ourselves and bringing our charts or whatever and learning music that way. And then now, you know, we gig together, we still jam together, we get into the studio together, and we create together in that way.
Mm.
As in, like, you know, a jams vibe.
I mean, for me, there's definitely that, in that the first gig I had coming out of university was a month-long tour at Courtney Pine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's literally, like, I finished in June, and in July it was on the road with, like, one of my heroes at that time. And, you know, it taught me a lot about, you know, outside of the practice room, what it takes to actually deliver night after night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what he does. He gets on stage and he delivers, musically, whatever you think about, like, what the music is in itself. His approach to the seriousness of what he was doing or what he was trying to give the audience was, like, something that I was in awe of at that time. There have been other people, like, you know, from that same generation, like Byron Wallen, Larry Bartley, people like Kylie Tatum, who've all, you know, like, in that phase of, like, kind of become, like, cutting your teeth after college, you know, I worked a lot with. And then from a slightly closer generation to mine, people like Seb Rothrud hired me for Polar Bear. In similar, like, the year after I left college, I started depping in that band. And it was interesting having just, like, played a lot of traditional jazz and then all of a sudden being in a situation where you're playing with electronics and having to find a way to deal with that. You know, how to in some way be in the vanguard when I was just trying to play my instrument, you know. And then there's some other occasions where there's, like, be one-off times of playing with, you know, veteran musicians. Actually, I recorded an album with Malatius Dake, so we toured with him for a bit, and that was, well, a big learning experience.
Mm.
But I played with Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra. And that was a massive, you know, inspiration. One of the big things that happened in that period, or that kind of gig, was, you know, he comes into the rehearsal room, like, really grumpy. He's just a grumpy old guy. And he comes in, he's frowning, and we're trying to rehearse the tunes before he gets in. And he just stops the band. He's just like, everyone, stop, what are you doing? He just looks at us and he's like, what are you guys doing?
Mm-hmm.
And he just, like, sneers at each of us individually. And he goes, guys, this is music, man. It's not hard, you know. You guys just sound like you're so stiff. You know, just listen and play from your heart, man. What are you guys doing? And it's like he was disgusted with the, like, stiffness and squareness with which we were playing this music that's supposed to be joyous and heartfelt. And I was like, actually, you've got a really good point. You should be disgusted with us because this music is about the heart, you know, and we're just looking into the music page and like, oh, have I got this right? Oh, you know, am I playing this correctly, dynamics? And he's just like, look, that's not the point of it. And it's a big lesson. It's like, in some ways, I think just that amount of contact with an older musician can stay with you for your whole life. It was, you know, that little, like, 2 minute exchange taught me that actually don't forget the priorities of music. It is about listening and playing what is in your heart.
Yeah.
And everything else supplements that.
Yes, you took 6 years between albums. So what was the transition, you know, what happened between those two records that, and, like, you know, did the first one not go the way you planned and so you hung out until you had a better idea, or what was, you know, what was sort of the reason for the gap?
Okay, so there are lots of different elements. So first of all, financial, because I funded the first and second album on my own, really. So I had to take on any tours or gigs that I got to pay the bills, basically. I mean, everything was done sort of on mates' rates and, you know, stealing studio time, that kind of thing. So that's why it took a long time for both albums, really. You know, and I mean, I did get quite ill during the first recording, so yeah, I had to sort of put it off quite a few times. And then I also had three big commissions, so I had to prioritize those. There was one with for Birmingham Jazz Lines, which Shabaka played in. It was a piece of music that was inspired by the work songs of the Bahraini Pearl Divers and the women drumming groups. So that was a, you know, big thing, and I had to put a lot of research and time and effort into that. And then the Women of the World suite that Nabaya was in. And then I did something with the LSO as well, London Symphony Orchestra. So yeah, so I had a lot going on, and then, you know, touring with these New Puritans and other things with my bands as well. And yeah, it was kind of hugely busy and with lots of ups and downs. So yeah.
I have just two final questions. The first is about the We Out Here compilation, which is coming out in February.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about the sessions and about how the whole thing, you know, came together? And I don't have a full list of personnel, so how much overlap was there between groups and things like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the session came together. I think it was the brainchild of Giles Peterson. He runs Brownswood. And I think he just could see that, you know, this is a particularly vibrant moment in history. It's not the only moment that's been vibrant, but at the moment it's vibrant in a way where all the things have lined up in that people can actually see, you know, this is a time that we need to acknowledge and actually treat, you know, treat with care. One of the aspects of treating a period of time with care is documentation, because history only sees things that are documented, either orally or, you know, with technology. So they decided, let's have a kind of record document of the things that are going on in London at this time. So all the bands, you know, all the crossovers, the kind of, you know, a cross section of the scene and what's happening. So we put together, I musical was MD, I kind of was a part of the processes of organizing what was going to happen in terms of like the kind of the shape of the project. And yeah, it's an overview of what's happening in London at this time.
Mm-hmm.
The sessions, we recorded 9 bands in 3 days, so 3 bands a day, and they each had a 3-hour slot to record their track. And for me, it's like, that's the spirit of those, like, you know, 1950s Blue Note jazz records, where you come into the studio and you're getting a snapshot of what a working band is doing. It's not a matter of creating a studio document that you slave away at, or you're kind of spending a lot of time conceiving. It's like, here is a band that's playing, you know, doing gigs to an audience. Let's put them in the studio and really get an idea of this is what's happening today in London. And that's what we get. That's what we did.
Yeah. And Nubaya, you're on 2 tracks. Cause
you're
on 5 of the tracks. Okay. Because 2 of your bands are there. So, yeah.
Yeah. So my band did a track. I'm on Moses Boyd's track, Theon Cross's track, Maisha's track. And that's it. Can't remember. Anyway. But it was a phenomenal experience, really, to one, have everything come together for those 3 days, because it's kind of reminiscent of us at Tomorrow's Warriors or at jam sessions or at gigs like Jazz Refreshed or Stees or whatever, you know. Now that everyone's, you know, busy doing tours all over the place, I think it's kind of the perfect time to just collect it all together in this format. And there's a documentary going alongside it that's looking at, kind of delving a little bit deeper into everything about What We're Doing, made by Fabrice Bourgeois. And I think both the record and having this film to go alongside it is kind of it's just a really honest depiction about what is going on. You know, a lot of people are talking about this time, what we're doing, and you know, who we are, and what music we're creating is. And so I think, yeah, I'm really excited to see where this goes and how it's going to be received. I think it's been great so far, so I've heard. I'm really glad to be involved in it.
And I guess my last question is, what do you think the economic and cultural ramifications, as the deadline gets closer and closer, what do you think the economic and cultural ramifications of Brexit are going to be? Is this something that you're starting to discuss with management and with European promoters and whatnot? And might it be worthwhile for the British jazz scene to maybe uproot as one and move to Berlin the way like all the free jazz players moved to Paris in 1969 from America?
Very complicated question, isn't it? So I get very angry whenever anyone mentions Brexit. You know, it's very depressing. As musicians, we're global people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, I don't like borders. I like to think we're all together. You know, we're all in this together. I don't really like to think about it too much because I think it's going to make things so complicated when we work in Europe. I mean, it's complicated enough as it is, but, you know, we're kind of, our freedom is being taken away from us because at the moment we can live, we can work, we can study anywhere in Europe without having to sort of fill out visas or anything like that, you know. But, yeah, so all of that's going to be taken away, so I'm quite upset. I don't know about how you guys feel.
I mean, for me it's upsetting, but in some way it's nothing in comparison to what people outside of the global west, the global north, have to deal with in coming anywhere around this part of the world.
Mm.
So for me, you know, it will be mildly irritating, mildly inconvenient in terms of us continuing to work in Europe, but it in some ways will bring us closer to the reality that we are developing within a world of increased borders, and we are still on the privileged side of that. You know, it is us kind of screwing ourselves, you know, and that is clear from every type of focus group possible out there. But for me, you know, I mean, I've got my own, you know, like views on why Brexit is happening that you may or may not care to. It's a bit conspiracy theory, but, you know, it's, you know, for me, I think that Britain has realised that in the grand scheme of things, it needs to deindustrialise its population, its approach to the economy. You know, I think that it goes hand in hand with disseminating the education system, disseminating the health system, bringing down minimum wage, bringing down regulation in terms of the jobs, and all of these things are a part of the Brexit movement,
mm-hmm.
you know, to take us away from big bodies that can have regulation. So that, you know, if we look at the BRICS countries, Brazil, India, China, South Africa, the way that their economies have developed is by having mass amounts of unskilled labour that can do those jobs that you can't do with machines. So you can do most middle level jobs with machines now, but you can't do those things like call centers. You can't do those things like screwing like little widgets into Apple products that, you know, need lots of labor, but lots of cheap labor. And their economies have been able to be built on this mass of unskilled labor. I think Britain is trying to do what it did with the textile industry when it took it away from India, you know, which is have a situation where it kind of brings down the regulation and then brings all those unskilled jobs from the places that they outsourced them to, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And that this Brexit whole thing is a part of that shift towards that way of seeing our economy. So how that relates to me and music. I think that one of the functions of artists is to express, you know, like what's going on in the world, like the zeitgeist, the feeling, in ways that aren't articulatable with vocabulary, with like linguistic language. So you're thinking about all these things that are happening. We're thinking about the despair of Brexit. We're thinking about the way that it brings us more into line with the realities of the world at large. And then we put our instrument into our mouths and we play something. You know, we play something that we don't have the words to describe. And someone is listening to that and they go, I don't know what this is that I'm hearing, but somehow this reflects the angst or the unknowing or the general feeling that I feel when I read the news, when I think about the state that we're in. And for me, that's how all of these things connect, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I didn't think about it from that sort of, you know, we'll become the low bidder and take all these crap jobs, you know, sort of perspective. I felt like it's something similar to what's going on in America, where, you know, our government is saying if we kick enough people out, it'll be 1955 again and life will be awesome. You know, and that's it's just, you know, a ridiculous, you know, it
life will be awesome for some.
Yeah,
but there were still a lot of people in 1950s that were working in really, really poor labor situations.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That's the other side of it. Life will be awesome for some people. You know, it's those other guys that have to work with no, you know, with no minimum wage.
Yeah, so I don't know. But
I think in London we live in a massive bubble of what the UK is actually like in terms of its opinions to ethnicity and immigrants, basically. I think in the run-up to Brexit, I was convinced. I was like, there's no way this is going to go ahead. And as it got closer and closer, I was like, I left London to do a gig in the north, like Huddersfield or something, and it was the first time I'd seen firsthand that most of the banners around the town were vote leave. I think I saw one out of like over 100 that were vote remain. That was vote remain, basically. And that was when I knew. I was just like, oh God damn, like firsthand, you know, because London is a multicultural city. It's not perfect, like, at all in terms of that respect, but it's nowhere near on the same level as other parts of the UK, and you don't realize that. But the second you leave the M25, you know, when you're on the road or whatever, and you're doing all the venues in London or the festival circuit or whatever, and you step into service stations and you actually see what the UK is like in a bit, it's unforgiving, basically. So yeah, I'm really upset, obviously, and still kind of processing, even though everyone's known for a while. I'm still a bit like thinking about what it's actually going to mean for a number of different sorts of people. And yeah, I think I will be watching very closely to how the UK changes over the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing here. I mean, there's a lot of us who are just, you know, wake up in the morning and go, Jesus, he's really the president, isn't he?
It takes an event like Trump or Brexit to get the types of people that wouldn't normally associate themselves with being the bearers of change to think about what they could possibly do.
Yeah, I mean,
you know
that's,
what I mean? It's like,
that's the thing that I've been really impressed by politically in America in the last couple of months is there are all these Democrat candidates announcing for office who would never have contested that seat a year ago.
Yeah.
You know, there's people who have never, you know, there's people who have never run for office and they're like, fuck it, I'm going, you know, and a lot of the Conservative Party candidates, I think so far 30 of them have retired, have announced that they're retiring at the end of this term because they think they're going to get beat.
Yeah.
So it takes a kick, you know, to get things moving, but it's like, it's still a terrible, terrible situation.
It is. Problem is, the right has been, in some ways, organized and and aggressive for a long time. Like in England, the two biggest red newspapers are the Daily Mail and the Sun, which are very right-wing, very anti-immigration, very pro-Brexit. And they've been doing their thing, you know, spurring out untruths, spurring out distortions of like the realities of what the country is going through for ages. And the left kind of like says, oh, maybe we should take them to court. Ooh, maybe they should print a retraction. You know, and it seems like, look, you guys at the left need to just start using some dirty tactics, or else you're going to wake up and realize that, you know, if the right are the only people that are going to use dirty tactics in terms of just really being aggressive, you know, they're just going to win.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like it takes a big thing like Brexit or Trump for the left to wake up and go, hey, if we just stand on the sidelines with our ideologies, you know, we're just going to wake up and realize they've just strong-armed themselves into power forever.
Yeah.
And these are the events that makes normal people go, hey, we can't just pretend that we're a part of the liberal, or what you might refer to as the liberal kind of masses. We need to actually have a position. We need to say we are against fascism, we are against racism, as opposed to just being, we are safe and comfortable in the position that we are in, you know.
Okay, that was my interview with Yaz Ahmed, Nubia Garcia, and Shabaka Hutchings, all up-and-coming players on the British jazz scene. This concludes this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Thanks.